Now, if you were tuned into RTE Radio 1 over the new year, you might have heard a special Mooney Goes Wild broadcast from Harper's Island Wetlands Nature Reserve in Cork. The programme focused on wetland birds, species that depend on marshes, lakes and estuaries for survival. Every winter, thousands arrive in Ireland from further north to escape harsh conditions. Among them, curlew, teal and black-tailed godwits, long-distance migrants that travel thousands of kilometres to reach our shores. Now, for this special edition, Niall Hatch, Declan Murphy, Jim Wilson and I were on site recording all the comings and goings at the reserve. The programme was first aired on the 2nd of January, but you can still enjoy the full programme along with stunning images captured by our cameraman, Donal Glacken, by visiting www.rte.ie/Mooney Goes Wild and click on Wetland Birds. Here's a taste of what we saw on the day.
Well, Derek.
Yeah.
I'm here with our very patient cameraman, Donal Glacken. We've been getting excited about various birds coming and going and asking him, can you film those? Can you film these? Can you film? Because there's so much stuff here this afternoon. It's absolutely fantastic. And at the moment, Donal, you're actually filming some Dunlin, a lovely little flock of these, probably our smallest wader on the reserve, like a miniature curlew in some respects. It has a relatively long beak, but the bird itself is no more bigger than a starling or a blackbird. Have you filmed wildlife before?
I work full-time as a cameraman. I've always had an interest in filming wildlife. So when I was growing up, I would have spent a lot of time in Donnymount looking for foxes, looking for kingfisher down there. So just kind of exploring my local patches, really.
Well, Donal, as we can see here, you've got a lovely shot of that flock of Dunlin on their private tiny little island. What are you using to get these shots?
So it's kind of a combination of two things. I have a Sony FX9, which has a 6K sensor, so we can digitally crop in. And I also have a 200-600 lens. So when you have that crop, I think it comes to about an equivalent of 1800mm. So even from being way back, you can really get right in and see the birds. Now, but the Dunlin, they're quite small.
Yeah.
So you can't really get that full frame, and they are probably about 100 metres out. So, but still, like the shot we have there, I'm quite happy with it. It's quite clear, so yeah, it's using the combination of the sensor and a big long lens.
I mean, that's incredible because they really are quite far away. And also today, it's very dull. The camera seems to be incredibly good at handling the low light.
Yeah, well, that particular camera is really good for low light. Now, I would say in another hour or so, if we're still going, I'll need to adjust it a little bit. But even at that stage, I had full confidence in the camera. Not a bother with low light at all. So, yeah, not a problem.
Right, Donal, thank you very much. Go back to the day job, will you? Niall, you want to talk about the Dunlin as well?
Dunlin, charming little things. Dinky little birds. When you see them next to the curlews and the godwits, they look so small. But they're little fighters. They really travel long distances. And I think of them as the heartbeat of a wetland like this.
No, absolutely. I mean, some of these Dunlin may have even bred well above the Arctic Circle. We know that some of our Dunlin come to us from Greenland, stopping off in Iceland and ending up here and sometimes going much further south. There's other Dunlin, like the Irish Dunlin. There are not that many Irish Dunlin. We don't have lots and lots of the suitable habitat for the Machair and places like that. But we do have some breeding in the west, in particular, the west coast and that. But also then we get Dunlin from Scandinavia and parts of Europe as well. And that's just fantastic. So really, without ringing them, we wouldn't know. But we do have a resident ringer of the birds, Barry O'Mahony, who's featured on the programme once or twice. Mm-hmm. He's had Dunlin here that were ringed in southern Sweden. He's had Dunlin here that were ringed in Poland. And it's only by doing that work do we actually join the dots and we see the links between Ireland and other countries, that it's not just about looking after our birds, we're looking after the birds of people from all over Europe.
The Dunlin has what we call a circumpolar distribution. You find them all across the tundra zone of the Northern Hemisphere, coming down into sort of the bog areas of Ireland. We're sort of the very southern edge of their breeding range. And it shows you probably a little bit about how Ireland was during the Ice Age. It would have been paradise for Dunlin at certain times during that, when we had much more tundra. Now they've retreated and the population is lower here. I find them really charming little birds. And in the winter, when you're at a place like this, the rule of thumb is you either see none or you see hundreds. They're never really by themselves.
Yeah, that's true, because we've been here a while now, and little flocks of them coming in over the seawall every now and again. And it's because their feeding area is becoming covered up with the sea as the tide rises. And they know Harper's is a good spot. It's a great spot to rest up and take a break and get the feathers organised. And there's been pockets of them popping in. So the numbers are building. And in January, we've had over 1,000, nearly 2,000 Dunlin here. Quite spectacular. But even today, when we have a few hundred, if you've never seen them before, they're amazing. And for, as you say, such a tiny little wetland bird, and to be able to travel all those distances. And they live reasonably long time as well.
It shows that it pays off to nest in these very remote areas, because it might seem very harsh, and it is to a degree, but actually there are very few predators in that tundra zone. And then, of course, then it means that they have to retreat when it gets the Arctic winter, it gets very dark and very cold. But it means, conversely, they have a very long summer with lots of light, lots of insects that they will feed to their chicks. In the summer, to feed the chicks, they switch a lot to insects. Then when they come here to Harper's Island, they're feeding on mainly the invertebrates that they'll find in the mud.
Well, it's a bit like, I know when we were growing up, you had... There was food you ate in the winter and there was food you ate in the summer, and never the twain would meet, you know. You wouldn't be having strawberries in December back then. And it's true that, you know, your diet had to change with the seasons. We don't do it so much anymore now that we can get almost anything from anywhere. But for these birds, that's exactly what happens. And for some of them, even their digestive tract alters and changes with the seasons, to accommodate the type of food that they're eating. And these birds are eating tiny little snails called hydrobia. And they eat them, shells and all, the whole lot. And then, isn't it, it goes into the gizzards? And
yes. And it gets ground up there, because birds, of course, don't have teeth. What they do instead, they swallow stones, gastroliths, we call them. Right. In the case of a bird like the Dunlin, it'd be little bits of grit, really. And they use that to grind up those snail shells and macerate the food to make sure that it's broken down, that they can digest it. So they're getting lots of energy there, and calcium, which they need for their bones, particularly, and for the females to create their eggshells. So if they don't eat enough snails during the winter, the female won't have the resources in her body to lay enough eggs when it comes to the summer.
They look happy out there despite the light shower of rain that's falling now. I think I saw some red shank there also.
Well, I guess you must have spotted the red legs then, Derek.
I did, behind the Dunlin, yes.
That makes the red shank one of our easier waders to identify. Now, a lot of people find them difficult to separate, but the red shank, you look for those red legs. It's a good chance you're looking for a red shank. Indeed, that's what red shank means. One of our commoner waders, and one of the more widespread ones in the winter, the core Irish breeding population has declined quite a lot. Unfortunately, that's a common theme with many of our breeding waders. But they're still quite reliable in many sites across Ireland in the winter months, and one that I always like to see.
It's extremely widespread, and it makes its presence known because it's a very, very noisy bird as well. And at the slightest disturbance, red shanks take off and call. They're almost a bit like watchdogs, actually, of the wetlands and the estuaries, which makes them, when they fly off, their distinctive call, you have the distinctive red legs trailing, and you have big white wing bars out on the wings. It makes them instantly recognisable to anyone even starting off bird watching.
That's right, that big white marking in the wing, it looks like a wedge or a triangle at the back of the wing. It's very striking, and it breaks up that brown, because when they're at rest, if you don't see those bright red legs, they're actually very camouflaged, kind of like the curlew. They blend in very much with the background, but then when they take off, it's so they can signal to each other. You see that white flash, they know, oh, all the other red shanks are flying, I should join them, I don't want to be here all by myself.
And blending in, of course, is a problem for us when we're trying to birdwatch and we're walking along. You don't see them, and then all of a sudden they take off, they make their cries, and they alert all the other birds, and they all fly off. Now, red shanks, of course, breed in Ireland, as you said, and they're quite in the Shannon Callows and other places like that. And they have a very interesting habit that during the breeding season, we associate birds like this feeding here in Harper's Island on the mud. But in the breeding season, it's not unusual to see them perched on a fence post, which is very unusual for a wader that we're used to seeing walking in water, isn't it?
It is, and they'll sing from the top of those fence posts. And a lot of these waders actually have very good songs. We could do a whole dawn chorus programme, Derek, just about waders. But they're far less sociable at that time of the year. They tend to have their own breeding territories. They don't gather together in these big flocks.
flocks. Then in the winter, what they do is they do gather together, they pool the resources, more pairs of eyes looking out for danger, more warm bodies to huddle against if the night gets very cold. And this is the classic bird you'll often see standing on one leg out in these wetlands, all facing in the same direction so that the wind is having the minimum impact on them. And they're very general feeders. Like, we associate as the curlews we've seen and the black-tailed godwits, they feed in the water and probe down deep. But you see redshanks everywhere. You see them in deep water, you'll see them wading up to their bellies, you'll see them walking along on the mud flat picking, and you'll see them on the grass. So they're a very adaptive species. They're in a variety of habitats.
I always think of them as the prototypical wader. They're kind of average in every respect, kind of averagely long bill, averagely long legs, averagely long body size, all of those things. And that's really the key to the success. They're able to fit into a lot of different niches. They're not overly specialised like some of the other birds are. Like if you're a curlew, you need to be in a place where there's a depth of mud to accommodate that long bill. The redshank can actually survive and even thrive in scrappier habitats. They don't need quite such a big expanse of mud either.
I suppose that's the secret to their success, and that's why they're such a widespread breeder.
Lovely stuff. Thank you, boys, very much indeed. Just want to remind people that we are making a video of this and we'll match the sound to the pictures that we're looking at now. So if you go to the website rte.ie/Mooney, you'll be able to see the birds we're talking about today. Jim.
We have some teal over here, Derek.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest ducks we've got and one of the easiest to identify. Isn't that right, Declan?
Yes, and I don't think they're just one of the biggest ducks. They are the biggest duck.
I've read some authors suggest maybe eider is up there with the shell duck, but I remember growing up with shell duck being the biggest.
The important thing is it's a very large duck. When you look out, it's almost the size of a small goose.
Yeah.
And some of the older names for it do actually refer to it, I think, as shield goose. Isn't that right? And the shield is the refers to the colours that fly, because it's a very, very colourful bird.
Mm.
Now, as we look at them here in this light, they're white, and initially they just look like they're white and black, because in this darkish winter light. But when the sun shines on them, they have a lovely chestnut breastband, they have a very dark bottle green head that stands out, and they have these lovely red bills and legs. And the bills are critical to look at.
Oh yes, because if you want to tell the difference between a lady and a gentleman shell duck, it's the bill you look at, especially in the breeding season.
Yes, yeah. Because the male has a large swollen knob on the base of his bill.
A bit like the mule swan.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly like
similar,
the mule
swan. But I think this is, in this case, it's actually part of the beak itself, isn't it?
Yes.
Rather than a knob like you get on the mule swan.
It's part of the shield, the frontal shield. And we're watching them out here. They feed very differently to any of the other ducks, because we're used to ducks dabbling and grazing on the grass. But these are feeding on the mudflats. And I think I heard you mention the key food that's very, very important for them. It's a certain snail.
The name Hydrobia.
Hydrobia. And they eat a huge amount of these snails.
Mm.
And what they're doing there as we're watching them is they're going along, they have their bill on their ground. And if I remember rightly, they kind of filter these snails out.
They do. They are like a humpbacked whale, believe it or not.
They don't look like one.
No, they don't. But they feed in a very similar fashion. They've got what they call lamellae, which are like grooves on the upper part of their mouth, and these act as filters. So what they do is they take in the water with the snails in through the front, and they squeeze it out the side, and all the water can go through the grooves, but the snails are trapped and they eat them.
Now, of course, when we're saying snails, everybody who's listening has got this image of the snail that we see going around the garden. And of course, we're not talking about anything like that at all. These snails are tiny. I mean, and I've been told they're possibly the most numerous life form on a mudflat here, such as that down where we are. Is that right?
Well, I've never really thought about it, but now that you mention it, I would say probably yes.
Yes, it's a very high density, and that's what these birds are here for. So we're watching, because the shell duck is a big bird, it has to eat an awful lot of these snails to get through it, and they're feeding away out there. And there's always, when you see one, look around and you'll see another. You don't just find one shell duck.
Yeah.
Because they stay in pairs the whole time throughout the seasons. And the male, apart from the bill that we discussed, is the same colour as the female, which is very unusual in ducks. But that's because shell ducks have a very unusual breeding strategy. They don't breed like other ducks.
No, they don't. Like we were, you know, if you look at like the mallard, the female's dull brown, she sits on the nest. He's all colourful. He doesn't, for obvious reasons. You don't want to get caught by a fox. With the shell duck, though, it is very strange. A, they like to nest underground if they can, or deep in the recesses of a bramble bush. They will often use old rabbit burrows or even evict rabbits out of burrows, and they will lay their eggs in there. And then when they come out, you've the male has been standing guard while the female has been in on the eggs and stuff like that. And when the chicks hatch out, they bring them to the water and both of them look after them, which is why they say their colours didn't diverge, because they have like an equal opportunity parent, and unlike the others.
It doesn't matter what colour you are when you're in a rabbit burrow under the ground. There's no risk to be seen to predators. Exactly. But the interesting thing about shell ducks doesn't just stop there with the young, because as the young grow older, they have this very, it's absolutely fascinating, this migratory pattern. Because we're used to ducks migrating from their breeding grounds in the Northern Arctic down to here to winter and then go back. Shell ducks breed in Ireland and they winter in Ireland, but they don't just stay here. They go elsewhere in between, don't they?
They do. It's called a molt migration. They literally migrate so that they could molt their feathers and get a new set for the coming winter. And they all go to a place between Germany, Denmark, that area called Heligoland.
Fascinating stuff as always. You can watch and listen to the full programme by visiting rte.ie/Mooney and clicking on the link for Wetland Birds. We'll do it all again next week at the same time. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.